I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. The Supreme Court today voted 6-3 to uphold a key element of Obamacare, ruling that federal tax subsidies to help millions of Americans afford health insurance are legal. It was the second ruling from the High Court that affirmed the Affordable Care Act, which now covers millions of Americans. We'll get reaction to the decision after the news. Plus, the personal information of close to 18 million federal employees may have been compromised in a massive hack of the government. Sean Gallagher, Baltimore-based editor of Ars Technica, the news website, discusses the government's outdated security technology. And we'll get a perspective on what a breach of this magnitude could mean for Marylanders. That's Midday. First, more on the Supreme Court ruling from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, Western Maryland, WYPO over on the Eastern Shore in Ocean City. Hello, Ocean City, and streaming to you live through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day. Coming up later this hour, we're going to discuss the data breach, the big hack at the Office of Personnel Management, an intrusion that could compromise the personal information of as many as 18 million current, former, and prospective government employees. Sean Gallagher, the Baltimore-based editor of Ars Technica, will be joining us to talk about that and other tech news, including the new microchips in credit cards and some of the latest, greatest apps. Earlier today, as you just heard on the news, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an integral element of the Affordable Care Act. In a 6-3 vote, the justices ruled that nearly 6.4 million Americans currently receiving subsidies in some 34 states under Obamacare were entitled to keep their tax credits instilled in the program to help them afford health insurance. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, wrote the majority opinion. He was joined by Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. In the minority, again, Clarence Thomas, Justice Scalia, and Justice Alito. This is the King versus Burwell case, and we're going to go over it now with two people who have been a great help to us here on the show. First, Jay Hancock, senior correspondent from Kaiser Health News, formerly of the Baltimore Sun, has been so good about explaining all these various legal challenges the last couple of years. Jay, thanks for joining us again.
Dan, great to be here.
And Amy Dillard is back with us, too, associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, who's been closely watching the Supreme Court. Amy, thank you also for your time today.
Happy to be here.
But, Jay, let me start with you. King versus Burwell. Let's just, as simply as possible, explain to folks what this challenge was.
The challenge had to do with the tax credits, the government subsidies that were available to people to buy health insurance through these exchanges, these online marketplaces that people have heard about. When the ACA was passed, Congress figured that it was going to need a lot of government assistance for people to get in and get the health insurance that at the same time the law was requiring them to get or be fined. So it made available these really generous tax credits to pay for premiums in these online marketplaces. The law was not written as cleanly as it should have been. It made reference to subsidies being available in marketplaces established by the states, and the plaintiffs in this case argued that that meant that the subsidies would not be available if the state didn't set up its own exchange like Maryland did. Maryland has Maryland Health Connection, but a lot of states didn't do that. They relied on a federal portal called healthcare.gov. And what was at issue was whether billions of dollars in subsidies would be available to people who were using healthcare.gov. And there were a lot of dire predictions made if those went away, but in fact they're not. The court ruled in the White House's favor, and the subsidies are going to be there, and a lot of sort of gloomy predictions about what might have happened to insurance access and affordability, those will not come true.
We should make the point that this whole challenge was over four little words out of this massive document, correct?
Yeah, the words were established by the state, Congress said that the subsidies will be available through an exchange established by the state. They evidently forgot to say that they would also be available through an exchange established by the federal government, and that was what the argument was about. It seems like a trivial thing, but if those subsidies aren't available in states that didn't set up their own exchanges, and there were 34 of those states, then suddenly a huge financial support for a very big part of the Affordable Care Act goes away. And so a lot of people, there were predictions that 6 or 7 million people would have lost their coverage because they couldn't have afforded it anymore. And that would have led to further undermining of the insurance markets as well as the whole ACA.
Congress passed the Affordable Care Act to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them. That's Justice Roberts in the majority opinion. Quote, the combination of no tax credits and an ineffective coverage requirement could well push a state's individual insurance market into a death spiral. It is implausible that Congress meant the act to operate in this manner. Jay, before I let you go, is this a surprise to you? I guess there were a lot of folks who were concerned that this could have gone the other way.
There were, I don't know. I'm usually wrong about when I make predictions like this, but this time I was right. It seemed hard to believe, given what we know about Roberts's role as sort of a mediating, compromising influence on the court, given the role that he played 3 years ago when, you know, Obamacare again was under challenge. And he was the deciding vote in upholding the law. It seemed hard to believe that the court was going to rule against it. Yet the three justices who dissented, Justice Scalia wrote up, a fairly typical Scalia-like scathing opinion, saying that the court is playing political favorites and that it's prepared to fudge the law according to political considerations. And Scalia even said, maybe we should stop calling it Obamacare and call it SCOTUS Care. SCOTUS being the acronym for Supreme Court of the United States. It's a little jab there by Justice Scalia.
Yeah, he's good at that. Jay, one last thing before you go. You, in your report today for Kaiser Health News, you say by no means ending the legal and political assaults on the Affordable Care Act. I understand political, although that seems to be, we don't see as much of that now as we did a couple of years ago. But anyway, legal assaults. Do we expect the Supreme Court to take this up again in some other way?
Not very many people expect to take it up again. There are suits out there looking at various aspects of the court. A lot of them have to do with reproductive health care coverage. Some of them have to do with whether or not the administration had the authority to delay some of the implementation of the act by a year. But a lot of people I talk to don't think these are going to go anywhere. They think that the court is sending a signal today to lower court judges that it will not look kindly on consideration of these cases. But the political, don't forget the political implications as well. We do have a presidential election year next year. And one of the key indicators now will be to hear how much talk about Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act that we hear from Republican candidates. The question being, are they going to say, implicitly say uncle and move on to other issues, or will there be the political support out there and the political voice given by the candidates to continuing to work against the Affordable Care Act? And so we'll have to wait and see what people say.
Well, that's why I say I don't hear as much of that as we did a couple of years ago, and I don't expect that to be as hot an issue going forward. But we'll see. Jay, thank you for your time again.
Nice to be here.
Yeah,
thanks, Dan.
Excellent. Jay Hancock, senior correspondent now with Kaiser Health News. You can find his report at khn.org, his story on the front of their website today. High Court upholds health law subsidies. Amy Dillard, we'll go to you next because you've been keeping an eye on the Supreme Court for us, and did this surprise you, the ruling in King v. Burwell?
Well, I joined Jay in not liking to make predictions publicly, but I did think that this case would come out this way, especially after the Chief Justice join the majority on the question of the subsidies in general. You know, this is one of those cases where if we could step back and take politics out of it, there are some very clear rules about how courts should interpret statutes. And what we see is the majority applying those rules, and then we see Justice Scalia in his dissent trying to apply the rules to a different end. That is, you know, there's an argument to be made on both sides about what this language and exchange established by the state means in 36B. The majority is reading that in a broader context where the Affordable Care Act in great detail explains how exchanges will be set up in states where the state does not set up its own exchange and that it will be done by the federal government. Justice Scalia is taking a very narrow reading and saying an exchange established by the state is just, you know, on its face means a state-established exchange and doesn't leave room for a federally established exchange being used in a state.
You know, but that looks past all the other language in the Act. And as Justice Roberts says, it is implausible that Congress meant the Act to operate in this manner.
Yeah, you know, the rules of statutory interpretation, which have been being developed over the last, you know, hundreds of years, kind of operate in a hierarchy, some people think. And the first rule is that the court should look at the plain language. And that's what Scalia does, and that's what he does, and he focuses down on it and shows other examples of where the state, in fact, should be read to mean the state as opposed to the state or the federal government. But, you know, the next rule in that hierarchy is where the language is ambiguous, where it is not as plain as maybe we would all like, then we start to read that language within the broader context of the entire statute. Scalia maintains that exchange established by the state couldn't be plainer. And Justice Roberts reads it contextually, which is to say, you know, an exchange established by the state must have a meaning beyond the plainest by the state. Otherwise, the entire Affordable Care Act, the court would have to basically undermine it to a place where it would be destroyed.
It would be destroyed. It would blow up. So it's hard to believe that the justices don't feel some pressure not to blow up the system. 6.4 million people.
Yeah, I mean, and beyond that, you know, just from a lawyer's perspective, you know, there's another of these statutory interpretation rules, which is that the court should not interpret a statute to negate the statute's own stated purpose. And I think, you know, Justice Roberts and the majority, you know, really hang their hat there. It's clear to the majority what the stated purpose is of the Affordable Care Act, and to interpret this little part of 36B would destroy it or undermine it to a place where it would be destroyed. And majority finds that couldn't have been Congress's purpose.
Amy, before we break and say goodbye to you for today, do you agree with Jay that this ruling sends a message to the lower courts about further litigation over the ACA, that they ought to be careful about what cases they agree to hear, rulings they make in the future?
It's hard to say. You know, like everybody else, I've read it. I've given it my one read to make sure that I understand what the court's doing, but I haven't really parsed it yet to see if there's more sort of hidden meaning in what the court is doing. But, you know, with a six-person majority with Justice Kennedy joining in this, perhaps there's a message that picking at the language in this way might not be a worthwhile pursuit while this is the configuration of the Supreme Court.
And just before you go, Kennedy's position in the majority, that is significant.
Well, I mean, it only shows that, you know, there are six people who think that language in the statute is going to need to be interpreted within the context and in a way so that it doesn't destroy or undermine the whole statute. I mean, that would be the sort of general, interpretation of what the six votes mean.
Right. But he had earlier been among the the four justices who didn't look so kindly on the law.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to know whether he's I tend to think people are not moving around according to politics or to bigger purposes, but that, you know, he's just looking at the question that's presented in front of him with these rules, and, you know, he just agrees that this particular language has to be interpreted in the broad context of the whole statute with an eye towards the statute surviving interpretation.
Amy, thank you again.
Happy to, Dan.
Amy Dillard, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, talking to us about today's decision in the Supreme Court in that King versus Burwell case, upholding the Affordable Care Act again, and the particular part of it, the subsidies for states without their own exchanges. 410-health insurance exchanges. 410-662-8780. If you think you've been breached, we're going to talk about the big hack next of the government database, the Office of Personnel Management. Sean Gallagher of Ars Technica will be joining us in just a minute to talk about the big hack. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Sean Gallagher now, Baltimore-based editor with Ars Technica, the news tech website, the tech news website. How you doing, Sean?
Okay, how's it going, Dan?
Good. So catch us up on the big hack, the Office of Personnel Management of the federal government. The number is kind of staggering here, 18 million present, former, and even prospective federal employees.
Right, as well as contractors and state and local government employees and many other people who are connected to the government through the need to have a security clearance or just to have clearance to get into their buildings.
What happened? Big hack?
All right, so this starts last year. Last year, the Office of Personnel Management had a contractor called USIS, U.S. Investigative Service, that was hacked. And some 400,000 people's investigation information was exposed at that time. That was
investigation information meaning background
meaning
checks?
Background checks. When you go to get a job with the government, they do a background check on you to see if you're suitable for federal employment. If you're getting a security clearance, they do even deeper investigations into your background. They do adjudication on things like, have you had affairs? Have you used drugs? Things like that. If they discover things in your background, they then basically bring you in and they interview you again and say you did this and this and this. What do you got to say about that? And
magazine subscriptions.
Everything. So they interview your family. They interview your friends.
Video rentals.
They probably go into that too. I mean, there have been people denied clearances for having smoked marijuana, having had affairs, having had things happen in their legal life. I know a guy who was an NSA employee who lost his clearance because he was in the middle of a divorce and his wife claimed he had violated a protection order. He showed up at her house, and that was enough to get his clearance revoked. And he then was put on administrative leave and then lost his job.
Would that stay on file, so to speak?
That would stay on file. And they keep files on people who are currently active or anybody who might then be investigated again for clearance purposes. They were supposed to investigate people who work in federal buildings. So if you remember the Navy Yard shooting a few years ago, this company, USIS, the original contractor company, had screwed up on his interview, had screwed up on his background check and had not found things about his psychiatric information, things like that. In any case, USIS got hacked. They got basically fired by the government. They brought in another company called Keypoint last year. Keypoint got hacked. And when Keypoint got hacked, the attackers got credentials, the logins for people from the company, to go into OPM's, into the Office of Personnel Management's background investigation system. So the attackers, who are believed to be Chinese, basically went into the portal to get into the Office of Personnel Management systems, logged in as people from Keypoint, and got into the systems, and then from there worked their way through. They also got into a data center run by the Department of the Interior's business center, which is a shared service. It runs like a cloud service for different government agencies. And they got into the OPM's employee records files. So they got everything like training records, employee actions, administrative actions against employees, promotions, pay grades, things like that.
On promotions, I was going to ask you. So if you're a government employee now and you're looking for a promotion, you need additional clearance. Maybe you don't get it because of something in your record, but they don't fire you.
They don't fire you if you don't need that.
I mean, that would stay. That would stay
in the system. So what they're saying is that originally what happened was that when OPM discovered the breach, which, by the way, they discovered because they were in the process of upgrading their systems to protect themselves better, and they had a software vendor come in and demonstrate their software against some of OPM's log files, and the company that was doing the demo found the breach. They found this evidence of malware on their network.
That's
how they discovered it, according to people who've reported on it. So basically, I'm coming in. I'm trying to sell you a software package to help you stop viruses. And said, well, just take a look at one of these computers and stick this floppy disk in and see what happens. Right? So they found this breach information, and they immediately brought in the Department of Homeland Security's U.S. CERT, which is the Computer Emergency Response Team.
That went all by me real quick.
Okay, so they
brought in the Department of Homeland Security.
Department of Homeland Security has a group called U.S. CERT, which is a Computer Event Response Team.
Okay. Meaning when somebody gets hacked,
they come in and they figured out what happened.
Yeah.
And they found the virus, the malware that was in the system, created a snapshot of that, and put it into the government's intrusion prevention system to try and stop other agencies from getting hacked. Since then, the archives had a false alarm. National Archives had a couple of files on three computers test positive for the malware, but then U.S. CERT came in and said, no, those are just files from Internet Explorer. They're not malware.
So far, it's just OPM. Limited to the Office of Personnel Management that we know. And the number 18 million is the potential number.
Because the systems that the OPM tap into, systems at the Department of Defense, this joint adjudication system that they use to give security classifications, security ratings to people in DOD, and it taps into other systems. It pulls information from the FBI's database on the criminal background database and things like that. So there's all this data that's pulled into this central verification system. It's called CVS. That's the back end for the...
And that's part of the hack?
That's part of the hack. They got into that system.
So. I have to ask a question to our audience because we have a lot of federal employees that live here in Maryland and listen to Midday and WYPR. And I'm wondering, in early this month, the Office of Personnel Management made this announcement. And they said they were going to notify, at that time, 4 million people that their personal information could have been potentially compromised. And I wonder, I don't know if anyone wants to call in and share that with us, but perhaps you received a notification like this.
And they knew about this in April. They've discovered this problem in April. In May, they rushed out a contract to get a company to do what they called Privacy Act event services.
I love all this terminology. Privacy Act event services.
So they went to this company and they ordered initial batch of about 3.2 million, support for 3.2 million federal employees for breach of privacy.
You mean insurance?
It's insurance. It's liability insurance. It's credit.
So the government's worried about getting sued.
Oh, yes. Obviously.
Yeah. All right. So I have a question I got to ask you. I appreciate all this information, really. First of all, I want to ask you two questions. What is Deep Panda?
Okay.
And why is Deep Panda doing this, supposedly?
So Deep Panda is allegedly a Chinese cyber espionage group. And that's the name that was assigned to them by one group of security researchers. There's other names that have been given to them, like Shell Team and things like that.
I like Deep Panda.
But Deep Panda is the most compelling name, right? You think of Kung Fu Panda. You think of Jack Black hacking into your system as a panda.
Are these government employees in China?
They may be. We don't know. I mean, so there have been a number of attacks from China that have come from people who work in the Chinese military. They're People's Liberation Army soldiers who have been trained to hack.
Okay. Why?
Well,
I know, think it probably what you can sounds do with like this. A naive question, but I want to know why anybody wants to get into the government's personnel files.
Well, they've also hacked Anthem, the insurance company, the health insurance company, and they're believed to be tied to the hacks of United Airlines and a number of other businesses.
What's it getting them, though? What is this about?
Okay, so think about what you can learn from somebody by looking at their Facebook feed, right? So you say, oh, I'm going to travel today. Oh, you know, these are my friends. This is
okay.
where I work, things
if
like that.
If I have an intense interest in that person, thinking about hiring them, or maybe they're going to marry my daughter or something. Maybe. Why would I want to know that?
If you had all this information, if you're able to correlate all this information together, it's similar to what the NSA does when it collects information on foreign governments and foreign people in general, from the internet, from telephone data and things like that, and sort of the same stuff they got out of looking at all of our phone metadata. They are able to see what relationships are, but then they're also able to identify by if you go through all this data, you're able to identify people who might be potential targets for turning as an agent for espionage purposes, either through coercion or through bribery or things like that. You look for people who have had financial problems.
So the hack could include people in the intelligence field?
Absolutely.
People working now at that place that shall not be named down in near Fort Meade?
Oh, absolutely.
The big black building?
No.
Big glass building?
I know that there have been reports from people that, yes, the people who work there have been exposed. People in DOD have been exposed. The FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, everybody but the CIA.
You report today in Ars Technica in your story on this that some people are concerned about their family's safety.
Absolutely, because if you think about what goes into a background investigation, it includes everything about you. It includes all the things about your family, where you live, what your kids do, what your husband does. If you're targeted by a foreign intelligence organization because you happen to work in intelligence, how are they going to go after you? Well, they're going to go after your kids. They're going to go after your husband. Okay. Go after your wife.
You know, I was being a little glib here earlier, but now I'm thinking about it. I didn't appreciate that it could be people in the intelligence field as well.
Well, it's absolutely targeted at people who have access to sensitive data. But it's also an opportunity to do huge economic damage to the U.S. Because if somebody has all this information, if you think back about 2 or 3 months ago, not even that long, about a month ago, the IRS had to shut down a system financial fraudsters who had obtained data from hackers, people who went to these dark net trading places on the internet and got access to social security numbers and other information that had come from corporate hacks. These financial fraudsters bought that information and used that to go in and get people's tax information to file fraudulent tax returns to get refund checks from the federal government.
Right.
Well, that was with about a couple thousand social security numbers. Now, if you had enough information on 18 million people to file a tax return for them, which you would if you had all this background investigation information.
This could include social security numbers, right?
It indefinitely included social security numbers for many of these people. So this would allow someone to essentially try to get the IRS to pay out refund checks for as many of these people as possible, just as an example of one possible attack. You could also go after all these people to ruin them financially and make their lives miserable. And their clearances are based on whether they have good financial records. You know, people have had their clearances revoked for having bad credit because credit checks are part of the background clearance.
What does OPM say about this, the Office of Personnel Management?
They're as angry as we are, they say. So this is what it boils down to. OPM has had a very bad track record with security as long as OPM has existed, as far as I can tell from the research I've done. I mean, back to the Reagan administration, they had a horrible problem with how they even did backups and disaster recovery. There was one occasion when they had a water main break in the data center for the OPM when they were still responsible for running paychecks for the government in certain areas. And they had just happened to have a backup that a contractor did from a few days earlier, and they had to fly the tapes to Atlanta to run the paychecks and for federal retirees. And if that contractor hadn't done the backup which wasn't necessarily authorized, mind you. They had said, well, we don't need backups. Then there wouldn't have been any checks.
Any records ignored.
Right. There would have been no pay, there would have been no retirement checks.
Yeah.
And
now you're saying, to pull this back into 2015, they're still behind.
Oh, yeah. Well, for the past, for at least the last 10 years, they've had security problems. And since 2014, the Inspector General at OPM has been saying, or actually since 2011, the Inspector General at OPM has been saying the system is broken and needs to be fixed. It's a dire emergency. It's a material weakness of the security. And he recommended that the systems be shut off because they were a security risk until they were fixed, until they were certified and given what they call authority to operate based on having had a security audit. And the director, Archuleta, said, yeah, well, let's just keep it going.
Is that the woman who's presently
in charge? Yes, she's the current director.
What's her name again?
Archuleta.
Archuleta.
Yes.
Yeah. She's saying
we're trying really hard.
Right.
So that's what it boils down to. She came in 18 months ago, and she said she started off this big push to fix the security at OPM, and she and the CIO, but they've also just frozen security checks on a lot of these systems while they're being modernized. And I can talk a little bit about how bad the modernization of those systems is as well.
Sean Gallagher is the Baltimore-based IT editor for Ars Technica. His story today on the front of the Ars Technica website is about this. Bob in Baltimore giving us a ring about this breach, the big hack at OPM. Hello, Bob.
Hey, how you doing?
Did you get a notice about this?
Yeah, we got an email about a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago about it.
And what did it say?
Basically that it was breached, I think it was affected, I forget how many million people it was.
Well, we're saying 18 million, but yeah, what did it tell you? What advice did you get out of this letter?
Well, basically said that to stand by, that they're going to notify anyone. We still haven't been notified, at least as far as I know, on an individual basis, whose information was taken, and that they're going to offer, you know, the usual credit monitoring services and so on. But right now, it's been a week and a half, I guess, since we were notified. But as far as I know, nobody has been notified on an individual basis yet. And I should say that OPM sent out another email just a couple days ago that they were hacked again.
Right. So they're treating these as two separate breaches.
Right. So then there was the last one was a $4 million in the hack into the background checks
right.
or clearances.
Right.
Bob, you're with Homeland Security?
Yeah.
Yeah. How concerned are you about this? How old are you, Bob?
I'm actually in early 30s.
Yeah. What is your concern about this?
I mean, it's concerning. I think the most concerning is the clearance breaches because of how much information is in there, and it, you know, especially in the intelligence community, it has an effect where they know what levels certain individuals are, and they can more actively target those individuals. And it's especially with what he was saying about with social security numbers and taking it and using it for financial means with the clearances, that's a big deal. That's one of the main reasons that people get denied their clearances is because of the credit.
Have you heard from some of your coworkers, colleagues about this? Have they talked about it?
It actually hasn't been. I mean, everybody, it almost seems like you know what's going to happen at some point or another. So no one that I know has seemed like terribly alarmed about it, which is, I'm not in the...
So some of the people who've actually gotten notified by this about this already
mm-hmm.
have thought that these were phishing attacks, that they were attempts to get them to get more information.
Oh, the notices that came.
Right, because the way that they came, nobody told people where they were coming from, and they came essentially as a form letter from, I think the company is Windvale, the company that got the contract. So they're not even coming from OPM directly, and they're going to federal employees, so they could end up in your spam bucket.
Oh, so Bob, you actually haven't seen that yet. You haven't seen an individual notice.
Right, correct. Yeah. I haven't seen an individual notice, so it could be in a spam bucket, I guess.
All right. Thanks very much. I guess, you know what Bob was saying about how you kind of expect it to happen? It's like you sort of expect somebody to, I don't know, maybe hack your credit card.
Well, in this case, it's what I think he's saying, and and
well, all of us. That, I mean, all of us expect.
At this point, you know, we're just all waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
We all are expecting the worst at this point because
but not personnel files. I think most people were thinking that. Most people think about credit cards being hacked
right.
or a bank account, maybe.
Well, when the government gets hacked, there's all sorts of information in the government that can be used in different ways, and the only thing of value in the government, ironically, is that an agency that has had the worst security amongst many of the agencies in the government. You know, the OPM has had such bad security for the past decade, at least, that and has had repeated warnings about how bad it was, and it only has gotten worse because they've outsourced so much of what they do to outside contractors, and a lot of these people are working from home, and they're using Gmail to send stuff back into the. So
why we have to take a break. Come back. We'll talk some more. I have a couple more questions for you. If you have a question for Sean Gallagher, please give us a ring right now. This is the time to do it. 410-662-8780. Sean Gallagher of Ars Technica. More on the Big Hack when we get back. Back with Sean Gallagher from Ars Technica. So a couple more questions. With 18 million people's files potentially breached, we could be talking about tens of thousands of government employees with top security clearance?
Yes, yes. I mean, this includes people who are congressional staffers as well, and probably people at the White House. So we're talking about people at intelligence agencies, at law enforcement agencies, and also, honestly, people in state and local law enforcement who have had clearances to work with the FBI in
Immigration Service,
and people in who are first responders. So all those people.
Another why question for you before we go to the phones. Why does the government farm out this cybersecurity work to private contractors? Why doesn't this OPM do it?
The background investigation stuff has been contracted out because it's part of the overall refocusing government has done to try and reduce the number of federal employees involved in these things, because it's been an ideological thing with Congress. It's been an ideological thing with a lot of past few administrations up until when Obama said we want to start having more federal employees doing things. But that momentum hasn't really stopped yet because we don't have a lot of people who have these skills in government anymore. And this started back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Since the 80s, people have been talking about the brain drain of IT people from the federal government, because a lot of people who had skills who in IT who were in the government back then started to retire. All the baby boomers are retiring. And so there's been a lot of people leaving government service who had skills in that area, and they were generally replaced by contractors, and usually by the lowest bidder in many cases. So a lot of these small, medium-sized, minority woman-owned businesses that sort of cycle through these contracts, same employees, just get laid off by one company, get hired by another. They're in there doing the dirty work of running a lot of these operations, these IT operations.
Let's take a call, another call for Sean Gallagher. Valerie in Baltimore, you're on Midday. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm a former federal employee. I had top secret clearance, and I worked overseas. I left a government employee in fall of 2013. 2 days ago, I received a letter from a CSID, Secure Processing Center in Michigan, signed by the head of OPM, informing me that my data was among the data that was hacked. And I have two questions. One is, why did it take them so long to inform me? The letter was postmarked June 19th. And secondly, how can I trust this CSID entity in Livonia, Michigan?
Right. So those are very good questions. So the first question, why they didn't inform you for so long, is because they were not even aware of the security background check breach until very late in May. They knew that there had been a breach of their systems in April, but they had not really narrowed down what had been breached until late May. Originally, they thought, and this is based on their testimony and And there's certainly some dispute about their testimony, because some people think they broke up these two things to try and prevent having to report so many of these things and give them more time. But the way that they've told it is they found the personnel record breach first, and that they felt only applied to about 3 million people at the time, only about 3 million people. So it was active federal employees. Almost, there's about 4 million federal employees right now. The background check breach they discovered late in May, and they weren't even really sure about it then, and they didn't report it to Congress until early in June.
Now, her other question, she's got the it's Valerie, who's got a notice coming in from center in Livonia, Michigan.
Right.
So, to your point earlier, how do you know that's for real, right?
That is, and that is a good question. So, you know, I would definitely I would double check on this, because and there's a certain amount of suspicion about all these things, because now that this has happened, lots of people are going to jump on this and try and get you to click on something if they have something that points to you as being a former federal employee.
Go online,
Valerie,
an account, enter a lot of personal information.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Valerie, I have a question
dollars.
For you. Valerie,
mm-hmm.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because we're short of time here, but I want to ask you this. Now that you've received this notice, and let's say you trust the notice or you find out that it is, in fact, from the Office of Personnel Management, what do you do with this information? The fact that your file has been hacked, where does that leave you?
Well, it's very troubling because of all the information that's in the security background check, of course, and also, you know, medical, family, financial data, my, you know, bank account and routing number.
That's what
and
I
all
mean.
That.
What is she supposed to do?
They're giving us 18 free months of, you know, monitoring plus. It's called CSID Protector Plus for
right.
18 months, and they offer $1 million of identity theft insurance for 18 months. So I figure that's kind of my option at this point.
So Valerie, I'll take a look when I get off the air. I'll take a look and see if CSID is involved in the Windvale contract.
That's the one in Livonia, Michigan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
You'll check, and then how do we get back
I'll
to
check.
Valerie on that? Valerie, why don't you give us your phone number off the air? Not on the air, off the air, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, all right. Al in Baltimore with a comment about this. Hi.
Hi. It just surprised me that everyone is thinking China, China, China. We don't even think about our own domestic terrorists. Like the Koch brothers and their hacking convention.
Okay.
And how like the
Koch
IRS,
brothers?
Do
the Koch brothers have a hacking convention?
Okay, so I'm not sure that the Koch brothers are involved in this, but there have been
they get accused of a lot of things on this show. So,
well,
and I'm never sure.
There have been domestic hacks of OPM in the past. In fact, in 2012 and 2013, hackers from the U.S., as far as OPM couldn't tell, broke into OPM systems and posted information publicly to humiliate OPM. And there was a lot of news about it then. It sort of went away. But there are other people who can hack into these systems. The way that the security was operated at OPM, I'll be honest, I probably could have hacked in. And I'm a journalist. So, I mean, I'm not a hacker full-time, right? I don't do this for a living.
Right.
So, I mean, basically all it would have taken is somebody to send an email to somebody with the right little piece of software on it, and they would have been able to get into OPM's networks.
Al, I mean, have you heard that the Koch brothers support hacking?
Oh yeah, they had something in the on Yahoo I was reading that they were having a convention trying to recruit hackers, and it just dawns on me how the lady from the IRS, all her emails are all of a sudden missing, and now OPM and. And also, it's funny when you think about Senator Wiener, you know, and how he has stated that he was hacked and all of his personal image
I think
of his colleagues. So it's a possibility, and that's a lot of information if you are a politically terrorist or a person who is just politically motivated to force public issues. Having all that information handy is just invaluable.
Sure, okay. Sure. And yeah. But, you know, at the same time, Occam's razor, you know, the simplest explanation is usually the right one. And we know that federal information systems, especially in civilian agencies, have had security problems for a long time.
Hey, before we let you go today, microchips in credit cards. This is a trend. This has been showing up. It's been in Europe for a while. It's coming here. More and more people are getting new credit cards issued with
the
chip in
them. The ones we're getting now are chip and signature cards,
mm-hmm.
which is different than what they have in Europe, which is called chip and PIN. The difference is that the chip keeps the card from being easily copied by a skimmer, by somebody running a – if you run a credit card through a slider thing right now,
right.
you're basically sending magnetic data to it. It's basically like you've got a piece of cassette tape taped to your card. That's what that is essentially.
Mm-hmm.
All the information is stored as bits on that tape or on that piece of magnetic stripe on your card. With a chip, that information is encrypted and is only accessed when – you actually do a transaction, so it can't easily be pulled off by somebody. It still can be pulled off, but it's not as easy to do, right?
And it's actually a different gesture that you make with it. You actually have to insert it into the scanner,
and
it has to sit there for a minute while it's verified.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, in Europe, they have a system called chip and PIN, where you have to then enter a PIN code to verify your identity, and that unlocks the encryption.
Oh, that's another step.
So that's another step. So mm-hmm. that's more secure, but again, it is not entirely secure. There's no such thing as entirely secure.
The reason I ask about this, are we seeing more of this in the United States now because of the hacks of Target and other...
We're seeing this, that's
Home
part
Depot,
of it. That's part of it, because the chip-based transaction, and also these new systems like Apple Pay and Google Wallet and things like that, they all take the point-of-sale system out of the loop in terms of getting the information from the card. You get the transaction goes from your card to the bank, and then the money goes to the retailer rather than the retailer handling your data. So in theory, things like Apple Pay and Google Wallet and then these chip cards are more secure. You're less likely to have your financial data exposed through the point-of-sale systems.
Thanks, Sean. We've got time for one more call. Elliot in Catonsville. Go right ahead. We're short of time, Elliot.
Okay. Well, the question in an excellent program is, what's the chance, what's the percentage that an ongoing assault could be happening today, this minute? In other words, a strategy where eventually they'll be found out, but they've got a second plan, a third plan.
I would say it's 99.999% probable. I think that
it's ongoing.
That's ongoing. I think that there's something we refer to this as the advanced persistent threat model now, where people are always trying to get in. Once they get in, they try to build their level of access over time. It happens in companies. It's not unique to the federal government. Every business that has a connection to the internet is a target for some sort of attack. And many of those attacks are caught. I mean, there are so many sort of low-hanging fruit type attacks, things that are based on old exploits and things like that, that happen every day. OPM says they're currently blocking 1 million attacks a day. Mm. Now, how you measure what an attack is open to interpretation. But the networks of the United States government are constantly under attack. People are always trying to get in. It isn't just foreign governments. It's anybody. And because it's a great giant source of data for all sorts of things. So that's one of the reasons why DHS has put in systems like Einstein to try and block these attacks. It's why the NSA is trying to contribute information to help protect federal agencies. But it's going to continually be a fight.
I have a feeling we're going to be talking about this again, Sean.
Well, I think we will.
Sean Gallagher, nice to have you back on the show. Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Boy, what a story. Sean Gallagher is the IT editor based here in Baltimore of Ars Technica. As I said before, a very rich website full of all kinds of tech-related news. You ought to check it out. Go to the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. You'll find Sean's latest story on this big hack at OPM. Sean, thanks again. Eddie's of Roland Park has lunch for you. Today's lunch from Eddie's of Roland Park, offering gourmet sandwiches, soups, salads, and desserts at its two stores on Roland Avenue and North Charles Street. Personal shopping, catering, and gift baskets are available at eddiesofrolandpark.com.